Welcome to the Conference for Women teleclass, Women Who Dare. Our guest today is Gail Sheehy, renowned author of 16 books, including the classic New York Times best-selling Passages, which was named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books of our time. Through her work, Gail Sheehy has changed the way millions of women and men around the world look at the stages of their lives. And as a literary journalist, Sheehy was one of the original contributors to New York Magazine and has been a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. Gail Sheehy's latest work is Daring, My Passages, a memoir of her life as a trailblazing woman journalist and author. We're going to be sharing highlights from today's call on Twitter. You can follow along and join the conversation at PennWomen, at TexasWomen, and at MassWomen. Gail Sheehy, welcome.
I am delighted to be with you.
Your new memoir is called Daring, My Passages.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering what the word daring means to you and why you chose that theme.
Well, when I finished my memoir after 3 years, I had to sit and ponder what was the theme of my life. We don't actually spend an awful lot of time sitting around contemplating that. But I was at an age in my mid-70s, and that was exactly the right thing to contemplate. And I realized it was daring. It was what I do to get beyond my fears. When I fear, I dare. It doesn't always work. Sometimes I fail. Fortunately, I failed early in my career, so I knew I didn't die from it, and I was able to do it again and again. But today, failure is kind of the default position for anybody who is daring or willing to take risks, start something new, open their own business, make their own app. You only get there by failing a few times, failing up, I call it.
And what is it, would you say, that holds women back from daring? What keeps them from doing the things you just described?
I think it's fear that you will be thought to be too impetuous, too aggressive, too unfeminine, and mainly that you will fail, that you will embarrass yourself, that you will show that you're not a master of whatever it is you're attempting to do. And so it's really important to try to do some things early in life that you don't master and realize that, hey, that's okay, you know, but I learned something new and I can do it from time to time, but I'm not going to be the champion surfboarder of the East Coast. And I write about a young woman on my website where I'm encouraging young women to share their daring moments. And she was a freshman in college. Her best friend was killed in a terrible automobile accident that wiped out her whole family. And the girl wanted to go to Cape Town, South Africa. It had been her lifelong dream. And so the young woman I wrote about, Jess, decided she was going to go to Cape Town for her friend. And she was going to learn how to surf. Well, she'd never followed surfing. She didn't know how to surf. She wasn't even a particularly sportive young woman. But she went to Cape Town. She used her own money. She found a surf shack. They gave her a job. And in exchange for that, she got housing and a place to surf and equipment. And she spent 6 months with girls from all over the country who were doing the same thing, all over the world, I mean. And she never mastered it. But she found out she didn't die from it. And she had a great time. She felt much stronger. She came back, and when she finished college, she was able to leave behind her major in art, and find that she liked writing, and went for an MFA program at Columbia, and is now in the middle of her first novel.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Let's give people that website for your Daring Project.
Oh, good. It's Sheehy Daring Project. It's S like Sam, H. Sheehy, and then daring, and then project, project.com.
.com. Okay. What have you learned? I mean, the story you just told was incredible. What else are you learning about interviewing women about their daring moments? What themes are you picking up?
Well, one of the main surprises is how many fears even the boldest women that we look up to have had to battle, notably Gloria Steinem, the icon of feminism. She was a colleague of mine back at New York Magazine in the late 60s and the 70s. I thought I knew her very well, but it was only when I interviewed her for a story for the daring issue of Harper's Bazaar, which will come out in November, that I learned what kind of incredible trauma she went through as a young woman who had a mother who was non-functional that Gloria had to take care of while she was a child, and a father who was charming but a vagabond and left the family when Gloria was 10. She didn't even get to go to school full-time until she was 11 years old. So her whole life was colored by this experience and never wanting to have the responsibility for anyone else because it only reminded her of how bitterly she felt and failed as a child trying to take care of a sick mother. But she conquered it. And conquered it over and over and again. And when Gloria Steinem tells people that she never wanted to be the poster woman for the feminist movement, people generally think, oh, well, that's just false modesty. But it's true. She was terrified. When she started Ms. Magazine, and then even though she had colleagues working on it with her, she told me I was scared, if I can use this word, shitless, all the time I was running Ms. Magazine. But she kept on, and that publication became kind of the script for women who were trying to master feminism. So
sure.
I find that these fears that we often cover by looking confident are pretty deep in many women.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your amazing career, which is covered thoroughly in Daring. What was your first assignment as a journalist?
Well, my first assignment I gave myself, I was working at the Herald Tribune, which was the petri dish for new journalism, and I was pregnant. 5 months pregnant, and I was afraid I was going to get fired because that was what people usually did in those days, because they didn't think you were going to stick around. And I went to the editor-in-chief of the newspaper and said, I'm going to be completely honest with you, but I'm pregnant. But you can use that. I'm 5 months pregnant, and that's when the intervention of medical care and maternity exams is most useful. And if you don't get maternity exams and aren't followed for the last months of pregnancy, the incidence of infant mortality increases vastly. And we have a terrible infant mortality problem in the United States and even worse in New York City. So let me go. I'll take on the role of a waitress working day to day as a single mom, and I'll see what kind of maternity care you get. And, free in New York. So he bought it. And I did a series of three stories about all the maternity clinics that are in East Harlem and the Bronx and all over the place. And it really got a lot of attention. The city government stepped in. They began closing some of the worst maternity clinics and developing neighborhood clinics that people could actually get to instead of having to go to a distant hospital. So I won an award for it. That was a nice confidence builder.
I can imagine that. I wanted to take just a moment to remind our listeners that we are sharing highlights from today's call on Twitter, and you can follow along and join the conversation at Penn Women, at Texas Women, and at Mass Women. So your first assignment as a journalist, Gail Sheehy, was a confidence builder. It was also a very bold way of turning something going on in your own life into a story that would resonate with other women. What was the hardest assignment you had as a journalist?
Well, the first of the hardest assignments, and there were many of them, was to go and cover Bobby Kennedy's presidential campaign. I'd never written a political story, and this was proposed by Clay Felker, who was then already a rather famous editor of New York Magazine. It had just started, and he came to see me up in my fourth floor walk-up on the Lower East Side in a limousine that he'd come from the Four Seasons where he had the opening night party and said, "What do you know about politics?" And I said, "Well, my father's a country club Republican and my mother's a bomb-throwing Irish rebel. So what I know about politics, this is about arguing at the dinner table." And he said, "Well, then you'll understand Bobby." I said, "Bobby who?" He said, "Bobby Kennedy." I said, "Why would I want to understand?" He said, "I want you to cover him in Oregon and California." I said, "I've never written a political story. I can't possibly cover Bobby Kennedy." He said, "Gail, everybody has to learn. The main thing you need to know about being a journalist," and this is the best advice I ever got, said, "don't just write a whole lot of little stories. Write the story that everybody is talking about and give them the why." Well, I went out on the campaign, and it was only a few days before he died, and he had to he had to go up and down the Cascade Mountains in Oregon for a last trip, and nobody wanted to go with him. All the senior reporters said, "You know, forget that. It's a thunderstorm. It was going to be a terrible trip." So I got on this tiny little plane with him. I got to sit next to him with Freckles the dog at our feet, and I got to interview him. I couldn't believe it. And we had a really deep interview, but the most important thing was as we were approaching the airport, the clouds descended and we were in complete milk fog, and all of a sudden something broke through and it was the nose of another plane heading straight towards us. And the pilots just dropped almost 1,000 yards in 1,000 feet at once. And the other two reporters on the plane shrieked. I couldn't even get a sound out of my throat. And Bobby Kennedy, while we were falling, said, "I knew Gene McCarthy was desperate. I didn't think he was that desperate." And we all laughed and said, "My God, what a fatalist." Thank God Bobby Kennedy was a fatalist. There had been so many deaths in his family. And that gave me the key to my story.
That's amazing. If you could go back and interview one of your subjects again, whether that's Bobby Kennedy or Margaret Thatcher or Hillary Clinton or any of the other remarkable people you've written about, who would it be? And what would you want to know from them?
Oh, I can tell you right away, I would like to interview Hillary Clinton right now. She's so guarded that there's no chance. But what I would want to find out from her, and of course I wouldn't ask her directly, but what I want to find out from her is, does she have the fire in the belly to run for president? I know it's what she's wanted to do all her life. It's what she's been groomed for. It's what she's given up a great deal for, and made herself, you know, the darling of the Democratic Party and the what appears to be the shoe-in for a presidential candidate. But I don't know if she has the fire in the belly. When she's interviewed now, she says, when she's asked, "Well, why wouldn't you run?" And she'll say, "Well, I have a really nice life now. I really like my life." And in other words, she has money, she has fame, she has the highest approval rating of, went way beyond Bill Clinton when she became Secretary of State. It's dropping now, as it would for anybody who's running for president, because that's the way our system works when you get shot at as a candidate. She's a grandmother. She's 68 years old. She can run around the world as the director, along with her daughter, of the Clinton Global Foundation. Does she really need to be, you know, cut up and thrown out the window and vilified and lies and all kinds of things spread about her for the next 2 years and then get to be president when the world is blowing up? I don't know. Does she really want to do that much? Now, she will do it, probably. Most likely she will do it. But I don't know if you can get elected unless you have the fire in the belly. That's what I want to find out by interviewing her.
I think there are many, many people who would like to ask the same question and figure it out as well.
Wouldn't that be an interesting story? Yeah.
That would be a great story. You have dared throughout your life. You were embedded in a war zone as a journalist. You were an activist. As you mentioned, you also dared to be a single mother while working full-time. Where did that come from? Where did that daring spirit of yours come from?
Well, I think some of it is inborn, but I also think a lot of it comes from being allowed to challenge yourself as a kid. And there was one study that seems to back this up. You know, when I was a kid in the late 50s, we didn't have helicopter parents. They didn't really much care once you were 10 years old if where you were on Saturdays, as long as you kept out of their hair and got home in time for dinner. So I was able, my grandmother gave me the opportunity to live out my dream, which was to follow a radio show that was called Grand Central Station, Crossroads of a Million Private Lives. And they were these tense psychological dramas by O. Henry that were acted out. And I thought, oh, my gosh, I have to go to Grand Central Station. I have to see these fascinating lives and write about them. And so when I was in seventh grade, my grandmother kept my secret and let me go, gave me the money to go and call her if anything happened. Somebody would push me up the washboard train steps so I could get up as high as those steps were in those days, go in from Amerenek, New York, 43 minutes to New York, go up to the balcony of the Grand Central Station and look down on this melee of people crisscrossing like crazy. And I'd see, you know, a woman in a floppy hat and a man with dark glasses, and they'd come together and they'd seem to be whispering. And I'd say, oh, they must be communists. They must be spies. And I'd get out my little pencil and paper and, you know, scrawl notes about them. And after I'd done that for a couple of hours, I'd take the train back, take my bike home, and write stories. So that was the idea of being able to do something and not get in trouble for it, nobody know about it, find out what another part of the world was like, and then make something of it, you know, art, pretend that it was art, was very confidence building.
Did that give you the bug? Did you decide as a child, I'm going to be a writer? Did you look at any other careers?
You know, I never thought of it as a career because I thought writers don't, you know, they just have to do that for fun on the side. You have to actually go to work in some office to make any money.
Gail, I want to ask you about the early days of your magazine career when you joined New York Magazine with a very charismatic editor, Clay Felker, who would later become your husband, from whom you learned a great deal and you worked with on some of the most amazing stories of the time. Could you give us a sense of what it was like in the New York Magazine newsroom in those days?
It was thrilling. We were, most of us were from the suburbs. We were fugitives from the suburbs in the late 60s, and we wanted to get into the city and get into the gritty parts of the city and figure out what was really going on. Tom Wolfe was our captain, and I remember him. I met him first at the Herald Tribune, where we were both working, and he had told me the Herald Tribune, New York Magazine, is the Tijuana bullring of competitive male journalists, but you have to be brave. So that was those were my working orders. And so I would give Clay outlandish ideas, and he would always love them. And I was always doing stories about social change, the first bachelor mothers, and many, you know, the changes that feminism were bringing, and all the divorces that were going on. But there were many other journalists who were joining in, and we had just a great club. And once a week we would have editorial lunches, and everybody had to come prepared with at least two ideas. So you could hardly bear to eat because you were so nervous that your ideas were not going to be good enough, but then you would get all kinds of cross-fertilization from the other writers at the table, and your idea would get better, or you would find that you would be given a source. So we had an absolute ball, and there was always, since it was the first weekly kitty magazine ever in America, we were just pioneering a whole new form. But the deadlines were killing because it was trying to put out what essentially a monthly magazine that explains the why of things on a weekly basis. So there was a lot of yelling and screaming and a lot of laughing and a lot of pot smoking late at night when people were in trying to finish up their deadline. And it happened so fast and was so exciting that we didn't realize what we were really doing, that it was a revolutionary kind of magazine concept. And we were living in the golden era of magazines, which has been declining ever since, not because of us, but just because of social change in the digital age.
I'd like to talk also about your book, Passages, which made you a household name and was a global bestseller. When was it published, and why do you think it resonated so much with readers for such a long time?
It was 1976, and it was the epicenter of the earthquake of gender. It was happening in the U.S., but it was also happening in other parts of the world, or it was beginning to bubble up. And here comes a book that gave people a new way of understanding their lives. It didn't replace ways that their therapists and what they had already figured out, but it gave them a way to say, wait a minute, I'm not the only one. I'm feeling uncertain. I'm feeling unmoored. The defenses I've had don't quite work anymore. I'm not quite satisfied with where I am in my life, with my marriage, or with my career, or with not having children. But that's okay. Now I can say I'm in a passage, and it's probably because I'm in this stage of life, or I'm in another stage of life where I'm much more contemplative. Does that mean I'm just slowing down? Well, no, it means I'm in another stage of life. And it was liberating to many people, men and women, who really had been trained to think that being safe, being set, being in kind of a corporate channel, living in the suburbs, having X number of children, being married, having a mortgage was the right way. And if you weren't totally satisfied with that forever, there was something wrong with you or your marriage or your work. But actually being able to change, feeling that this was normal, that it was healthy, and that it was the way to grow, liberated many people.
Now, you've started a new online movement, as we discussed earlier, called the She He Daring Project. This is an online movement. Tell us what it is and how women can participate.
She He Daring Project is my website in which I present stories of women, famous women, and everyday younger women who have dared in some way, small or large, as an inspiration to women to be more daring and to see what the payoff is. And I'm inviting women to send me a little capsule of their most daring moment, and I will then call those who sound like they have a really good story, interview them, and write their story and put it up online so that it will be useful to others. So I hope people will go to She He Daring Project and enter their stories. I want to hear from them.
Wonderful. So that's www.shehedaringproject.com. Hear more from Gail Sheehy. Please join us at the Texas Conference for Women on November 13th or at the Massachusetts Conference for Women on December 4th. This concludes today's teleclass. Thank you so much, Gail Sheehy, and thank you all for listening today.
My pleasure.